We turn in the Word of God to Joshua chapter 23. It is evident from this chapter that Joshua is coming to die. The prospect of dying brings a certain focus to life. Priorities get recalibrated. Things that are truly vital and significant take on a whole new importance. So here is Joshua looking death in the face. You see that there in verse 1, that he is old and stricken in age. Verse 14, behold, this day I am going the way of all the earth. So our theme this evening is, after death, what? After death, what? We notice first of all in verses 1, 2 and 3, God's servants die. God's servants die. Joshua was preserved to accomplish a task. And we have followed that task through this book, to bring Israel into Canaan in chapters 1 to 4. To take the land, chapters 5 to 12. And then to possess the land in chapters 13 to 21. So the reason he is old and stricken in years is due entirely to God. God has kept him alive so long. He is now indeed very old. He was born in Egypt, traveled with Moses through the wilderness those 40 years, and then he becomes Moses' successor. And being the successor to Moses, he led the Israelites into battle, one battle after another, and we have been with him, as it were, with those battles. We have stood and watched them almost as they fought and as God fought for them against the Canaanites. And then we listened to him and observed as he allotted the land to all the tribes. So a lot of things have been done in this man's life. He's been part of many things. He has witnessed many things. That was his life's work. And that work is now complete. And you will have noticed, we pointed it out last time, we noted again this time, these remaining chapters, chapters 22, 3 and 4, are a series of national assemblies called by Joshua. We had the first there in the last chapter, chapter 22, which we studied under the heading, Remember Ed. Now we come to the second assembly, and there will be one more in chapter 24. And the emphasis in this chapter, different from the emphasis in the previous chapter, here it's all upon what God did. Verse 3, ye have seen all that the Lord your God hath done unto all these nations before you. God's servants die, but their focus is upon the Lord your God. It's as if he is saying to them, look, I am dying. That's a simple reality. But you shall live after I am dead. And therefore your focus in life, your emphasis in life, your priority in life must be God. And he's saying to them, that is my focus. That has been my life. God has been my life. Now I'm coming to die. And I want to impress upon you that God should be the focus of your life. And that surely is true humility. Is it not true humility? He's not thinking about himself or thinking about his legacy. How often people, when they're getting near the end of their term, so to speak, they start to worry about their legacy. Well, Joshua isn't interested in his legacy. He said, you have seen what God has done. All these years you have seen what God has done. Let that then be your focus when I am dead and gone. God and what He has done. So God's servants die. But what a lesson they leave behind as they're coming to die. It makes us envious, doesn't it? But then second, verses 4 and 5, God remains the same. Behold, I have divided unto you by lot these nations that remain, to be an inheritance for your tribes from Jordan, with all the nations that I have cut off, even unto the great sea westward. And the Lord your God, he shall expel them from before you, and drive them out from your sight, and ye shall possess their land, as the Lord your God hath promised unto you. In chapter 1 of Joshua, it was all about the death of Moses. It was the end of an era. It was perhaps the most significant event after their redemption from Egypt. And people no doubt asked, even then, what's going to happen to us? Maybe even Joshua asked, I wonder what's going to happen now. How shall we continue without Moses? I mean, remember, these people grew up with Moses. Their whole life was dominated by Moses. How would they fare? What was the answer? God said to Joshua, as I was with Moses, so will I be with you. That was the answer. Telling them, Moses may be dead, but God hasn't died. God remains the same. So your life may change. Your life may change in many radical ways over the course of 10, 15, 20 years. And you may say, well, what now? But God hasn't changed. So in verse 4 he says, you have got the land, the nations have been cut off. That's the past right up to the present. As for the future, God will continue to work. God will keep his promise. That's what he says to them in verse 5. So he says, in other words, there's your past and there's the future. See what God has done. God will continue to be the same. I shall die. I will not be here to lead you into this new future, but God will still be here. And what is more, God's promise will govern that future. As the Lord your God hath promised unto you. So God's future work, like his past work, is governed by promise. And God will work everything according to his promise. Similar to the language of Paul in Romans 8. And that's what matters. God remains the same. Christopher Love before his death execution. Amongst his last letters to his wife, he says to his wife, "Have a care of thyself and babes. God will take care of thee and them. I can write no more. Farewell." You see what he's saying? I will die, but God remains the same. God will take care of thee and them. Like Joshua, Christopher Love knew that God remained the same. And his works and his promises will continue to govern life. So God remains the same. And that is a most important truth, is it not? That God is unchangeable. Unchangeable in his being, wisdom, power, holiness, justice, goodness, and truth. It's an unchanging God. He remains the same. I mean, that really is remarkable. The God that Abraham served is the same God we serve. It's astonishing, isn't it? The God that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob worshipped is the very same God. So their problems and trials and difficulties are often our trials, problems, and difficulties. But God remains the same. The eternal God. Thirdly, verses 6 through 13. God's demands continue. Joshua here issues a series of imperatives. Verse 6. "Be ye therefore very courageous to keep and to do all that is written in the book of the law of Moses, that ye turn not aside therefrom to the right hand or to the left." Be courageous to keep and do. Being a Christian requires courage. I'm sure when some of you were a lot younger than you are now, and maybe some rascal in the neighborhood, hearing that you were a Christian, said, "You're just a sissy." If only they knew what courage it takes to be a Christian. Be courageous to do, to keep the law of God. Verse 7, "Be separate and distinct, that ye come not among these nations, these that remain among you, neither make mention of the name of their gods, nor cause to swear by them, neither serve them, nor bow yourselves unto them." Notice all the negatives. Joshua isn't saying there are no positives. He's already given us some. But these negatives are of crucial importance. He has not only said, "Be courageous to keep and do." Now he says, "Be separate and distinct." The Canaanites are always problematic. They're always a problem. They're always a threat. And they always seem to have lovely, enticing things. On a previous occasion, the Israelites were tempted by what? They looked at the women amongst the Canaanites and thought, "Wow, they're not like our women." They were taught to sin. Very important moment in the history of Israel. And the Canaanites presented numerous other threats to the Israelites. Think of their religious worship. always seemed so flesh-pleasing, contemporary, mystical. Always had a lot of noise about it. Always very flashy. And the Israelites were told, forget about their worship. Forget about their gods. Have nothing whatever to do with it. All that the Canaanites are, were, and have was never to become part of the lifestyle, thinking, or in any other way of the Israelites. Be separate and distinct. Verse 8, be faithful. Cleave unto the Lord your God as ye have done this day. Be faithful. And you will notice the repetition between verse 10 and 5. The Lord your God, he it is that fighteth for you as he hath promised you. He's harking back to verse 5. You see, these demands require a focus upon God. How are they going to do these things? By going back to God. They were to be swallowed up, as it were, with God. Focused upon God. God is their priority. What God requires. And if they're not saturated with God, how will they ever be courageous? Separate and distinct. Faithful. In order to ensure that these things are not mechanical and formalistic, don't forget God. And there's one more in verse 9. He's saying to them, be loyal. Rather, verse 11. Be loyal. Take good heed therefore unto yourselves that ye love the Lord your God. Be loyal to God. Love him. And of course we know what the law says, to love God with all your heart, with all your mind, with all your strength, with every fiber of your being, every part of you must throb with loyalty, with love for God. But then he adds a warning to enforce all these duties. Look at verse 12 and 13. Else, if you do in any wise go back and cleave unto the remnant of these nations, even these that remain among you, and shall make marriages with them, and go in unto them, and they too, know for a certainty that the Lord your God will no more drive out any of these nations from before you, but they shall be snares and traps unto you, and scourges in your sides, and thorns in your eyes, until you perish from off this good land which the Lord your God hath given you. Joshua says to them very simply, if you do not these things, God will not do these things. He will actually do the opposite. He will not drive them out. He will reverse everything. Joshua may die, but what God demands, requires, and expects continues. You see what he's saying to them? There's not going to be any change in your life. None. The demands remain from one generation to the next. So, all of you who are older than 35, all these things apply to you. But when you're dead, they still apply to the next generation. And to the generation after them. That's what Joshua is saying. God's demands continue. And then fourthly, verses 14 through 16, God's faithfulness is certain. Behold, this day I am going the way of all the earth, and you know in all your hearts and in all your souls that not one thing hath failed of all the good things which the Lord your God spake concerning you. All are come to pass unto you, and not one thing hath failed thereof. Verse 14 here is the repetition of the key point of this whole book and of this whole history. It's the repetition of chapter 21, verse 45. There failed not out of any good thing which the Lord has spoken unto the house of Israel, all came to pass. Joshua is reminding them the whole point of this history, and he's reminding you the whole point of this book being written down is that you can see most clearly, unmistakably, God's faithfulness. The whole book of Joshua is designed to show you not one thing failed of all God said. All came to pass as God promised. Not one thing failed at any time. That repetition. The construction of the verse is constructed in this manner. Over and over and over, Joshua says the same thing. Each sentence is simply a repetition of the previous. But he goes over it. He has already stated it in chapter 21. Now he goes over it again in this 14th verse. So it's designed to impress upon you God's faithfulness. He is saying to them, there's the history. Hasn't God been faithful in your past? How have you gotten to this present moment? God's faithfulness. If God had not been faithful, you would not have gotten to this very point in time. So the history proves God's faithfulness. And he says all of this in order to draw the conclusion that he makes in verse 50. Therefore, it shall come to pass that as all good things are come upon you, so shall the Lord bring upon you all evil things. God's faithfulness is two-edged. We've noted that before. Yes, there is God's continual faithfulness in good things. But God's faithfulness is two-sided. There's God's faithfulness in his kindness. As God has been kind, so there's God's faithfulness in his anger. The Lord shall bring upon you all evil things until he have destroyed you from off this good land, when ye have transgressed the covenant of the Lord your God. So verse 15 has that device that Paul uses. As that, so this. As that is true, so this is true. God's faithfulness is certain in his kindness, so God's faithfulness is certain in his anger. And God's anger is as certain as his kindness. So Joshua is reminding them that God's faithfulness is an absolute certainty in life. It is an unchanging, resolute fixedness. Unshakable. Certain. Sure. Concrete. Real. God is unfailingly faithful in his kindness and in his anger. God's faithfulness is certain. let's come to the applications of this. First of all, we learn the essence of true piety. Joshua exemplifies true piety for us. He lived for God. He dies for God. With his last breath, he is speaking of God. God is central to his life. We think of Paul's words, "For me to live is Christ." You can't separate Christ from his life. So you can't separate Christ from his death. Absent from the body, present with the Lord. So he lives and dies for Christ. And Joshua lived and died for God. You think of Calvin's motto, "I offer thee my heart, Lord, promptly and sincerely." And Calvin defined piety as loving God, to fear and reverence God, and dreads offending him worse than death. What a comment that is. He dreaded offending God more than death. So Joshua is a model of piety. He's a pattern, an example to emulate and copy. We read this 23rd chapter. What do we conclude? Oh, to die like Joshua. To have our wits about us when we come to die, that we can speak like him. Dreading the whole idea of being in a hospital ward with all kinds of tubes in and out of us, unable to move or speak or even think. Though we want to die like Joshua, talk like him. But then secondly, a new era doesn't mean God changes. And that's quite clear in chapter 23. I die, but you live on. And all these things remain, the demands God makes, the faithfulness of God, everything carries on. Just because it's going to be a new era without Joshua doesn't mean everything's going to change. God is going to change. So we have to change. And so we see that emphasis by Joshua. The ongoing demands that God makes upon them. Look at what he says in verse 6. He says, obey the law. It's the law of Moses. It's the same old law. The same standard. The same policy. The same practice. Obey the law. That's what you have to do. Cleave unto the Lord. Verse 8. That doesn't change. Verse 11, loving God. That doesn't change. In other words, he's saying to them, duties and demands by God do not change from generation to generation. And yet how often the church has been infected with the idea that the old paths somehow or other become outdated and unsuitable for a new generation. And we can prove this from history. We could do it from our contemporary age, but sometimes it's more helpful to go back a generation or two. In the second half of the 19th century, it was a time of theological flux and turmoil in liberalism. And alongside that was the rise of what was known as the Romantic movement. And of course, it just swept across the whole culture, infected everything, and infected the church. And evangelicals, faced with this sudden change, said, well, how are we going to meet the demands of this new era and this new generation? What did they do? They said, we'll ditch doctrine because our culture is no longer interested in it. And so the great emphasis of the leading evangelicals of that period of time was this: life, not dogma. It became a mantra. So authority shifted from Scripture to the individual. This is whenever people started to talk about their experience. We think this is something new. In actual fact, the whole idea arose at this particular period in time. And the belief amongst these leading evangelicals was that by making such changes to meet this rising generation, they would win favor with them. And the church would remain in good standing and be popular. So instead of preachers reading John Owen and John Calvin, they began reading the romantic poets like Shelley and Coleridge, and preaching started to become flowery. And they would quote these, thinking, you know, that shows I'm in touch with the new generation. All sounds familiar, doesn't it? Let me give you two examples within Congregationalism. There was a complete collapse of orthodoxy led by Baldwin Brown and R.W. Deal. These were the two leading lights of Congregationalism. And they said, they taught the entire congregational denomination, you can't meet the needs of the new generation, of the young people of our new age, unless we make changes. So Calvinism was ditched. All kinds of doctrines were ditched. They changed their terminology, the way they preached and spoke. But the outcome is only too clear and sad. Amongst Baptists, the collapse occurred as well due to men such as John Clifford. Said the very same thing. To meet this new generation, this new era, we've never had an era like it before. So we're going to have to change everything. Be more contemporary. Be in tune with the romantic ideas of this new generation. You can almost hear them say it, even as you read it. And you know, you can read all this for yourself because they've put it in print at that time. The church forgot or ignored the injunctions laid down in Joshua 23. And notice what happened when they were followed and when they weren't. When they were followed, what do we read in chapter 24, verse 31? Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders that overlived Joshua and which had known all the works of the Lord that he had done for Israel. So when that generation after Joshua carried on what Joshua said, everything remained fine and stable. They served the Lord. But look what happens to the generation after that. In Judges 2, verse 10. And also all that generation were gathered unto their fathers. There arose another generation after them, which knew not the Lord, nor yet the works which he had done for Israel. There's a disconnect between that generation after Joshua and the next generation. They didn't pass on the demands that God makes to the next generation. What a tragedy, a disconnect between one generation and the next. So Joshua has it. He passes it on to the next generation. They maintain it. But the generation after them didn't even know God. That's what happens when you ditch the old paths, thinking the next generation needs something different. Joshua didn't believe it. Don't you believe it either. And then thirdly, a warning to sinners. Sinners need to hear that God is unchanging. that God is unchangingly faithful in his wrath. That is why hell is eternal. The unchanging fury of God's wrath upon sinners. Yes, God is faithful in his invitations to sinners. Come unto me, he says. Seek me and ye shall find me. A God ready to pardon. But he is equally faithful in his wrath, and sinners need to hear that too. But are sinners hearing it by and large in our generation? That God is unchangingly faithful in his wrath? Is that not why the love of God has become prominent? And the ungodly love to hear about the love of God. I'm not saying we shouldn't preach the love of God. But why do sinners love it? Because it has become divorced from God's unfailing faithfulness in his wrath. And fourthly, an encouragement to believers. Joshua is encouraging the faithful about the future. And he says to them, survey all that God has done in your life. Go over it all. Just keep going over it all. Over and over. And he's written a book. He's left us an infallible record of all that God has done in their lives. And he says to them in essence, do you think that God, having done all of that for you, that when it comes to your future, God will let you down? You can't believe that. You can't. God has done all this. He will never let you down. You will let him down. Absolutely. You will fail 1,000 times. But God will never fail. As Calvin puts it, if God has done the greater in saving our souls, he will not fail to do the lesser in keeping our persons. There is an encouragement to believers. Chapter 23 says to you, go over your history. Go over your history. See what God has wrought. And then ask yourself, will he fail me tomorrow? Next month? Surely not. Amen.